You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Harry's. Visit harrys.com and you will find out that harrys.com is a shaving company. And if you use the promo code BCS, you can save $5 off your first purchase. The cool thing about this, I'm actually holding the product in my hand. And it's kind of an old school shaving kit. The razor is very fancy looking. You can customize. You can go with the regular handle. You can go with the silver handle. That's what I'm holding. Or you can have a handle engraved. But the cool thing is that you're getting high tempered steel made in Germany. It doesn't dull as quickly as a lot of razor blades. And it's a lot cheaper. And I think what's really cool is they send you all the shaving equipment. So you don't have to go to the drugstore and wait for the guy to unlock the cabinet. That drives me crazy. If you want to get good razor blades, they have them under lock and key because people steal them. And you got to get somebody to come over and unlock it like it's a bar of gold. Then you go and pay $1 million for razor blades. And this with this experience, you can actually get a great shave with a really cool, I'm playing with the head. The head is rubber and kind of molds to fit your body here. I'm turning this into kind of, well, it's a little too erotic, so I'm going to put the razor blade down. But I like the feel of the handle in my hand. And the shaving cream smells really good. All right, enough. The point I'm making is Harry's.com is a place you can get quality razors, custom razors, at cheaper than what you would pay for in a drugstore, and they send them to you. You can save time. Who doesn't want to save time and have a great shave? All right? Harry's.com. Use the promo code BCS. Save $5 off your first purchase. And now, let's podcast. All right, everybody. This is the Brian Callen / Hunter Mont show. And our guest is Adam Monsbach, who wrote... what's really, we have him on here because he wrote this great book, this short book that Sam Jackson narrated that I listened to called Go the Fuck to Sleep. And I guess it was spawned by the fact that you know, I got a 5-year-old and I also got a 2.5-year-old. Getting those kids to sleep can be a very, very trying process. And I guess you wrote it out of frustration, basically, of saying, go the fuck to sleep. And it's basically a poem. And it's really funny, and I can see why. I guess you had it just kind of blew up out of nowhere, right?
Pretty much, yeah. It was not something I wrote with any expectations. I wrote it one night after my daughter Vivian, who was 2 at the time, had me in her bedroom for about 2.5 hours, and I came out and I made a joke on Facebook. I said, look out for my forthcoming children's book, Go the Fuck to Sleep. No, which I didn't have any intentions of writing, but as soon as I wrote that, I realized that I did know what that book would look like and sound like, what it would do, how it would kind of riff off of the existing canon of bedtime literature, which in my house anyway was very effective at putting the parents to sleep.
Exactly.
Did nothing for the children.
Exactly. So it just kind of was a happy accident.
Yeah, it was a happy accident. I wrote it a couple weeks after that and didn't even initially really intend to publish it. I just kind of like brought it out at parties, you know, but the response was really good. Among everybody, the young, the old, the childless, the child burdened. And so, you know, after a couple months, I sent it to a friend of mine, Ricardo Cortez, to do a couple sample illustrations. And then we sent it off to my friend Johnny Temple at Akashic Books, which is an indie house in Brooklyn. That was the only place we sent it. And, you know, Johnny loved it. But it's not like what Akashic does is publish obscene fake children's books. So, you know, there was like this...
Yeah.
This weird period where, like, he and I, he's like, I love it, man. My wife loves it, but I don't know if I can publish it. And I'd be like, yeah, you probably shouldn't. We're probably just shitty parents.
Right. Well, what's actually interesting, the interesting thing about this phenomenon is the fact that you did this independently and reached that many people where that wouldn't have been possible even 5-6 years ago, I'd argue, at least 10 years ago. And it feels like somebody comes up with an idea, they put it on Facebook, all of a sudden it becomes a book that everybody reads or at least knows about. And it feels like, you know, all of us are going to be self-publishing very, very soon here.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, it's a funny mix of technology and of a very old media kind of story, because I made the joke on Facebook, but that didn't cause anything to happen. That just made me think about what writing that book would be. And the reason that the book actually took off was a very old school one, which was that about 6 months before the book was going to be published, I gave a reading of the book. I had just gotten the finished version with the illustrations, and I was supposed to give a reading at a museum in Philadelphia as part of an evening of readings, like a salon kind of thing. And so I said, all right, let me read this book if they have a hookup for the projector. And I read it to about 200 people, and the buzz started there, like from this in-person author reading. Mm-hmm. And then it went to the internet, and people started pre-ordering it on Amazon. And within a week, it was number one on Amazon. And that led to media and all kinds of craziness, and the book, you know, kind of becoming this crazy word-of-mouth thing, and us speeding up the publication to get it out in time for Father's Day, and then a leaked PDF of the book ricocheting around the internet.
So you've made money on this book.
Yeah.
It's great to hear. That's great. And you'll keep making money. That's a beautiful thing.
Well, that's something that I did really, really want to ask you that I thought was fascinating is, do you think that leaked PDF, because, you know, I mean, it was that good for sales or bad for sales?
Ultimately, it was good, but we didn't know that at the time, and we were terrified because we didn't have a book at the time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to get too technical here, but the shit had not been published. It was not a physical object in the world.
Right.
It was something that we were, like, planning to publish, and all of a sudden, everybody had it for free, so we were terrified. Mm-hmm. But luckily, it's bad form to show up at, you know, a baby shower with, like, a low-resolution, stapled-together, you know, PDF that you printed out off the internet and try to give it as a gift. So it ended up being cool.
That's for sure.
Well, clearly, you hang out with much classier people than Brian and I do, that's what we bring all the time.
It's true. You're gonna pay for the packaging. You want to make it look good. It's got to be a book at the end of the day. When did you get the call about Sam Jackson? That must have been kind of exciting.
Yeah, no, that was great. I mean, that happened. So the book hit number one on Amazon and stayed there for like several months, and we did get it out by Father's Day. And by the time that we had an audiobook published and they were going out to find somebody to do the book was already kind of a big deal. So Sam jumped on it and knocked it out. The great thing about a book this short is that things happen really fast. Like, you know, Tuesday it was like, hey, Sam Jackson's going to do the audiobook. And then, like, later that day it was like, he did it. It's great. It's finished. You know?
Well, yeah, because the reading is about 4.5 minutes or something.
Yeah.
It's a poem.
He was like on Letterman reading it. It was crazy. So
you made money by writing you wrote a poem. It's a good poem. You're making money off it. You're a paid poet right now. That's very rare.
I may be the highest paid poet in America right now.
That's what's crazy. I love technology. We gotta write our book. I'm writing this book called The Manual about all things how to be a man, tongue in cheek. Should be fun.
But
maybe I should just write a really, really, really short one, because
that's right. Write a really rude children's book.
It's great. Well,
I gotta warn you that in the aftermath of Go the Fuck to Sleep, a whole lot of other people tried that, and it hasn't worked out that well for them.
Well, that's because you just did it so much better than anybody else could possibly do it.
There it is.
I appreciate that. At the very least, I did it before they did.
You are an author. I mean, you wrote... Tell me the...
Rage is Back, which I actually, unlike Brian, I actually read.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, so, you know, it's really, really good. I mean, and I was also really, really surprised because... You know, I guess I had a certain preconception of you from having read Go the Fuck to Sleep. And then, I mean, you clearly just understand the world of graffiti amazingly well.
Yeah, it's a world that I care a lot about and a world that I've been involved with for a long time. So
why?
You know,
why do you care so much about it?
Well, I mean, I came up as a hip-hop kid. I was a rapper. I was a DJ. I wrote graffiti. And graffiti writers were always the weirdos and the eccentrics of hip-hop culture. They were the kind of mad scientists and the guys who labored literally underground sometimes, and there was no possibility of getting paid for what they did. But they invented what, to me, is this incredibly vibrant art, and it evolved incredibly fast, and it was this kind of cat-and-mouse game. It was, you know, Zorro versus the Spanish, and graffiti writers know their cities better than anybody. They have really sort of unique views about law enforcement and art and vandalism. And, you know, to me, what's interesting about people and what I look for in stories as an author is contradiction and paradox. Mm. People who are willing to kind of hold opposing viewpoints in their minds at once, not try to resolve them, but live in the space of those contradictions. And graffiti writers are people like that, because to them, you know, the world wants to debate whether graffiti is art or vandalism. Graffiti writers are like, why can't it be both?
Right.
They balance fame and anonymity, right? They're famous, but under an alias, and yep. you don't want their real names out there.
Yep.
You know, there's this real kind of line that they walk between art and commerce and, you know, authority and freedom. And, you know, it's just an interesting world. The way that they talk, they use words like beautify and destroy almost interchangeably when they talk about what they do in their cities.
That is a great way to describe art anyway, in many ways. I mean, good art is supposed to disturb. Good art, I believe, in some ways is supposed to break down or shake up what you consider to be a belief system or the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm thinking about Bansky as you're talking about this, and why, and I don't know that he'd have the same impact if it was just on paper in a museum, even though it is now. What made him so powerful was, you know, you'd see things, he was, you'd be walking down the street and see something that was maybe not as convenient to look at, but it made you think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the inherent value of someone like that. So I can 100% see how art maybe, you know, I think art in some ways is always supposed to be a little bit out. You got to have some outlaw in art. I mean, as a mm-hmm. stand-up comic, one of the things that I really appreciate is the fact that I can get up anywhere and I can speak my mind. And a lot of times it's not politically correct. A lot of times it's going to piss off maybe 20% of the audience. I always say as a comic, you know, you should get to a point where 20% of the audience either doesn't get you or doesn't like you that much. Mm-hmm. Then you're probably doing your job. If everybody likes you, then you might be Gallagher and you're smashing pumpkins or whatever.
Well, that's the funny thing is, and then nobody actually likes you.
me and Dove Davidoff is a great comic. We were talking about like the one barometer, one metric of a good comic is laughter, but it's not the end all and be all. You can't just measure, yeah, okay, you do stand-up comic and you get up and you do comedy and you're supposed to get the room laughing really hard. You can also do that with tricks. You can also, it's kind of like the difference between Dylan and someone who's a pop artist who writes a lot of stuff that's, you know, really with full of tricks and hooks and catchy, and so they can sell out a big stadium. And there are some musicians that don't necessarily do that, but they have something to say. There's a message in it, and it takes a little time to listen to and appreciate, and you know, so I appreciate what you're saying about graffiti. I think it falls within that same sort of, it can at least fall within those that context.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the other things that I thought was so interesting about the novel as well is that, you know, there's this element of magical realism in there as well. You know, in the sense that it's the cityscape, but there are mystical forces operating, which I wonder, does, you know, your experience of graffiti and all that sort of stuff, did that inform that? Was that part of the choice, or?
Yeah, I think it was, in a sense that to me there is something mystical about graffiti. I mean, it's very ritualistic. A lot of it happens in sort of dark and scary places, tunnels, and you know, because of the illegal nature of it, there's a kind of, you have to be very much in the moment and very attuned to your surroundings. And I have a sense that graffiti writers in some sense are like urban shamans. So that dovetailed with an interest that I've had for a while in magical realism, and specifically in figuring out what a kind of modern contemporary American magical realism looks like, because mm-hmm. you know, it's a very culturally specific thing, right? Like, and you read Marquez or you read Murakami and you're like, okay, I don't quite understand what's going on here, but I can tell it's very rooted and grounded in the culture, whether that's, you know, Catholicism and you know, the particular religion of Colombia with Marquez, or Japanese, you know, myth and folklore with Murakami. But, you know, in this country, we don't really have an equivalent. Like, we don't mm-hmm. have any system that allows us to kind of believe in the unbelievable. And the hallmark of magical realism is usually that people accept the crazy shit that's happening and don't bat an eye. And I wanted to take those ideas and say, well, what would that look like in New York City? You know, if there was a building with a staircase, a 14-flight staircase that transported you 24 hours into the future, how would people even respond to that? How would they assimilate that information? And I mean, I don't do anything too inventive maybe with it. Like, mostly in my book, people are like, get the fuck out of here with that bullshit, you know?
Well, generally, I thought that.
Yeah, but it's fun. It doesn't have to be true. It can be symbolic. Right. I mean, that's kind of where the power lies. You know?
Yeah. And I thought also, I mean, the choice to have, you know, a staircase that transports you 24 hours in the future, and the fact that, you know, your main character is like, this is the stupidest piece of magic a person could have. Like, what's a person going to do with this?
Right.
And which is just such a...
I was interested also, there's a riff in the book about sort of like third-rate superheroes that my narrator, Dondi, as a kid used to invent these shitty superheroes like the Salamanderer, who has the regenerative powers of an amphibian. If you cut off his arm, it grows back weaker and smaller in 6 weeks, you know. Or he's got a guy named Diner Man who's got like superpowers, but only in diners, you know.
My guess is you like comic books.
You know, I feel like as a kid I somehow missed out on comic books. Like, I wasn't a comic book head. I mean, I was really into Star Wars and other fantasy stuff, but I never was like that dude sitting around X-Men. And I think it's too late now. Like, you can't be like a 37-year-old dude who just discovers comics.
It's so true. The magic of youth goes away, you know?
Yeah. Maybe it'll come around. Maybe my daughter will be into them. But I don't know. That notion of like useless magic, useless power, or power that's ill-suited for the situation is kind of another theme in the book. Like, another main character, the kid Dondi's father, has spent years in the rainforest learning from shamans and you know, talking to the higher spirits of trees, but it's like that's the magic of another culture, and it doesn't get him that far when he's in New York City. So these were like I wanted to play with.
I love that, man. I always think about Joseph Campbell wrote about the peyote Indian and why they began taking peyote. And one of the things was that they were laying railroads, and as there was an expansion west by the white settlers, they were killing all the buffalo. And when they would kill the buffalo, they would then lace the bodies with strychnine, and all the other animals would eat the buffalo. And what they were doing was taking the feathers of those animals and all the furs of those animals, shipping them east into Europe. So they wanted to kill as many animals as they could. I mean, the plains of America at one point looked like the Kalahari, you know. And it was, there's a term, scientific term, for when animals reach their apex. And around really 1800, and between 1800 and 1840, there were something like 500 million animals killed in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
Because buffalo will tend to herd together, and if you've got a big enough rifle, you can literally just sit there and take them off. And then they would stretch out those skins. But the Native Americans, their entire mythology was wrapped up with the animals around them, especially the buffalo. And so what they had to do with peyote was go within their own consciousness, because everything outside of them was dying. Everything outside of them was no longer there. It's a pretty devastating thing to think about. And human beings need mythology. It's funny you say Gabriel Garcia Marquez, because when I first read him when I was a young man, it took me a long time to understand the context of what she was writing. I didn't come from a culture that supported magic, you know, or the things that you're talking about. So I had to kind of take a step back and read it with different eyes, you know, even though, you know what I mean? So
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's kind of those were the kinds of things I was thinking about. How do you introduce these ideas like magic and mysticism in a context that is otherwise very recognizably realistic and real and familiar?
Yeah. Or at least teaching the value of that. You know, there's a lot of stuff that, so you can do magic, okay, I gotta pay my bills, and I don't, you know, let's not talk about magic, I'm a scientifically based minded person, blah blah blah, but there is context for it. There is value in things like wonder and romance and magic and you know, the idea of a portal that could transport you 24. That's the kind of stuff that's really, whatever, you can say it's not true, but man, I like reading about that stuff. It's very entertaining, man. It taps into a reality in my imagination, if there is such a thing.
That's I think that's a good way to put it. You know, I mean, I used to teach writing, and I would tell my students, my graduate fiction students, that with every book or every story, you're making a contract with the reader. You're making an agreement, and you do it very quickly within the first few pages, and you are setting forth terms about what you're going to deliver, what this book is going to be, what they can expect, and you're sort of trying to get them to buy into that. And then once they do, it's on you to sort of fulfill that obligation. And I think that if you are strategic and smart about it, and your story is compelling and you bring people in, that contract can say practically anything. You know, it can be totally outlandish.
Thank God.
People, they'll go for it. They'll be with you the whole way.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that, man.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, you really did, the Rage Is Back does do a great job of just creating this full world. I mean, it is a very interesting world. And, you know, I mean, obviously the relationship with magic is part of that. The world of graffiti bombing, which I certainly did not know much about. I watched that documentary. But, you know.
I just like the way you put it in the context, because I just was never around graffiti enough. And, so it's very easy to kind of dismiss it as just punks who are just,
you know,
as opposed to sort of artists who are expressing themselves because they don't have another medium to do so. You know, everybody wants to be heard.
Right.
You know, in one way or another. But talk a little bit about, it's interesting, you teach writing, you are an author, I'm sure you're working on another book. Talk a little bit about how you are, you are the father of a young child. I'm always kind of like, for me, and I'm a father of two young kids, I'm always kind of, I was thinking today about how the best way to raise them is in a world that's changing so quickly.
Mm.
You know, in a world that actually does more and more require all of us to think outside the box. Formal education is not the answer to our ever-changing world. I feel like the answer is really in figuring out a way to think outside the box and be innovative, be creative, and to be magical in your thinking in a way.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, no educational experience is ever going to match the impact of what your kid gets at home, you know?
Yep.
You know, your kid is going to be hopefully with you, you know, much more than they're ever going to be in a classroom or with a teacher. Mm-hmm. And study after study indicates that the kids with that kind of solid foundation, it's really hard to throw them off course. You can be a kid with active parents and books in your house and go to a totally mediocre school and be just fine.
100%. And you know what's funny about that is that where I live in L.A., man, is there so much emphasis on getting your kid into a good school with a high score. The problem is then you all of a sudden now you're living in a gated community and your kids are all going to this quote unquote great school with people of the same socioeconomic background.
And I'm the next thing you're living in Calabasas.
Yeah, where I just bought a house, but I don't want to talk about that right now. But the bottom line is that, you know, it really, you know, we have this instinct to protect our children, right? To make sure that they have a good education, quote unquote. I didn't grow up like that at all, thank God. So you got to be careful with giving your children too linear an experience, maybe. I don't know. You know,
I agree. I mean, there's a lot of anxiety and there's a lot of programming that goes on. Kids who have no free time to explore or even explore their own imaginations. And, you know, the world is changing, as you say. But, you know, when I was a kid, we had the run of the neighborhood. And there was just like a big crew of kids running around. And after school, every day we got together and we played basketball or football or we played games we made up. There was no supervision. And it was a little ecosystem unto itself. And if there were conflicts, which there always were, we had to work the shit out.
Right.
And I don't think kids today often have that experience of the freedom to just play in this kind of unsupervised way. We're too scared. We're afraid.
Yeah, it's too competitive. It's too competitive. You know, kids are getting into sports at a really young age, so you can't, if you want to play baseball when you're 14,
it's
too late, right? They're like, nah, you can't compete with these kids now. They've been playing since they were seven.
Right.
I was like, what?
And then, you know, but the other thing, too, is that the kids are being exposed to so much media at such a young age that appetite to just go out and be kids and play and run around is just, it's not the same. Like, I see kids all the time, you know, who are 2, 3, 4 plugged into an iPad. You know, their parents want to have a meal at a restaurant in peace, so the kids are plugged in, they got headphones, they're watching a movie or they're playing a game. To me, that's a problem.
I think so too.
I don't think kids that young really need to be exposed to any of that stuff.
The movies are so they're so hypnotic. Like, try competing with your kid when Frozen is on. Try competing with that kid when you got a flat screen TV that's 60 inches and surround sound, etc. Like most people do. Now your kids watch. I mean, I can't. I mean, for me, it's hard enough for me as an adult.
Yeah.
So,
and the thing is, unlike when we were kids, you know, TV programming for kids is now like a multi-billion dollar industry. It's not what it was back in the day when it was like, you know, you had Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers and a few cartoons. This is like competitive 24-hour programming. Enormous money has been spent to market to these kids at shockingly young ages. You know, there's no educational benefit to any of this stuff because kids' brains are not ready to process pixels at the age of 2 and 3 and 4. It's just, you know, if you read the studies, it's just, it's not recommended. And kids are just being anesthetized by a ton of media. So, I mean, for me, if I'm giving advice to parents, I say keep your kid screen-free, you know, for the first half dozen years of their life at least. And that's not to say that later on your kids aren't going to, you know, you're going to, like, I look forward to sitting down and watching, you know, the Star Wars trilogy with my daughter, but I'm not going to do it when she's 5,
right?
You know?
Right, exactly. I mean, hopefully in school they get a lot of interpersonal sort of,
Brian, have you looked at the teacher to student ratios in most of the schools in America?
I have not looked at that.
Well, Brian, there's not a whole lot of one-on-one time in most of our schools.
No, but I'm saying with each other. Kids get to play with
each
other.
Well, but also the way that schools are structured. I mean, it's those rows and rows and rows of desks. They're trying to do more and more group projects, but in general, it's not a very – school is not the most human place on the planet. It's a little bit institutional and industrialized.
Well, I gotta figure out a better school then.
Well, but I think that's the whole problem is that in general, people are always so focused on, I got to get a better school. And you're just trying to outsource the problem. It's like trying to figure out who you can outsource the problem to. And the problem is you can't outsource your kid's education. Like, you really have to take charge of it and figure out what are the things that are important for me to communicate to my children, the things that I know and the things that I'd wish I'd knew and wish I'd appreciated when I was their age.
Well, you're talking to a dude who I make videos, especially for my son. I'm more worried about my son than my daughter, maybe because he's a guy. Like, my daughter, I think about protecting. My son, I think about making in a weird – I know it's a chauvinistic – it's just an attitude I have. But I make videos just talking to him about the things that I wish I had known when I was younger, so –
Mm. You know. I like that idea. I mean, it's funny because it's a sprint toward some sort of destiny, and it involves, I don't know, getting into college and being in a position to do what you want in life. But the educational system is so flawed from preschool through college that it's like this constant race toward a crumbling finish line, to mix the metaphor. I mean, college right now costs more than twice what it costs when I was in college, you know, 18 years ago. It's damn near $200,000 a year. I mean, an education, you know, 4 years.
And now you're saddled with debt you can never pay back. Makes no sense.
I think there's a tipping point coming where a lot of kids who have the grades, who come from families that always wanted them to go to college, who saved for it, at some point are going to come to their parents and be like, look, this just doesn't make sense anymore. I don't want to go into debt. I don't want you to go into debt. I would rather start a business. I would rather do an internship. I'd rather take 35 grand of what we all scrimped and saved together and live on it for 2 years and figure out a better idea.
And by the way, learn online. I mean, nowadays you can get an education for $6,000 from a university, right?
Yeah, that's also coming. And I think at some point it'll have to be addressed because if tuition, admissions drop by 25% 1 year, these institutions are going to panic and they're going to have to recalibrate.
Well, what has to be separated is that universities provide two functions, the function of education and the function of accreditation. And those are, you know, the problem is they have a monopoly on accreditation right now, right?
Right.
And they don't really, I mean, universities don't really measure whether you actually understand whatever it is that you got a major in. They just have you take a bunch of classes, you get whatever grades you got in those, and then at the end you get this piece of paper. But it doesn't really say, do you really understand this topic that you were supposed to learn over these 4 years or not? And I think that's the thing. I think what's really going to change is when you split those two functions, when you start seeing people having, you know, oh, we issue a certificate in this, and that certificate starts to be actually much more meaningful than the universities, that's when you're really going to see the change, because then people are going to be like, oh, the education I can do on my own, and I can get this certificate by taking this exam for $500 as opposed to $200,000.
Hmm. Right.
Anyway.
There it is.
But yeah, no, I mean, the other thing is that it seems like, I mean, you know, I've also been poking around your website and, you know, you sent me those articles. You've been writing a lot of parenting articles that are very much in the vein of go the fuck to sleep.
Yeah, I've been having fun with some sort of short humor pieces. I've been doing a couple of those here and there for Salon and The New Yorker and Esquire and stuff like that.
Yeah, like 10 ridiculously useful.
Takes my advice seriously. I mean, that's the problem. It's like, you know... By being a fake parenting expert, you run the risk of becoming a real parenting expert, and then people are like, I tried your 10 tips, and they didn't work. And it's like, are you fucking kidding me?
Well, I particularly enjoyed Other Parents Suck. I think that was my favorite.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Well, it's hard being a parent, man. You got to go to birthday parties and talk to people you don't care about.
Well, I love this sentence. In practice, however, we mostly can't stand the rest of these ass clowns.
Yeah, I find that to be true anyway. I mean... You know, there's just, I mean, you know, I think the reason that, that Go the Fuck to Sleep ultimately worked is because there is all of this stuff that is taboo to talk about, to admit that you feel, and there's this sort of tremendous preciousness around parenting, you know, where everybody is occupied in pretending that everything is perfect with their kids, and everybody's, like, screaming in silence into the void at night, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it makes playgrounds, like, an awful place to be.
Well, you know, the other thing that I appreciated about just the poem Go to Fuck to Sleep is there's this tradition we have, and you know, at least among, I don't know, a lot of people I know is just protecting your children from reality. So my dog was dying of cancer. We had to put my dog to sleep. And my instinct was to say, just tell her, you know, we'll just say Lucy went off to a farm. And my wife said, no, man, she should be there. We should tell her what's happening. It's a very important lesson. And my daughter literally held the dog when we put the dog to sleep. And she took care of my wife. And she went and they buried the dog and they did the whole thing. And my daughter was fine. Even though she was almost six and she's very young, she was able to process it, and she was able to. It was a very important experience, and she wasn't traumatized. She was sad, and she was able to navigate that feeling, and then she came out of it 100%. And it was a very important lesson about life. I never really understood that. I never would have trusted that. My instinct was to protect her from that reality. But
yeah.
Thank God.
Well, it's important that kids. You know, obviously you've got certain things you want to protect them from and you want to ease them into, but yeah. I think it's important for them also to see the full range of our emotions so that they understand that, you know, your father does cry, your father does get angry, you know, these are acceptable emotions. It's nothing that you have to be scared of. You know, there's a full range here, and we can get sad, we can mourn, there's a process. You know, So yeah, it sounds like it was a good thing to do.
Yeah. Well, what is your take on education? I mean, on the best way to educate your kid? I mean, it's kind of an unfair question. That's a big one.
Yeah, it is a big one. I mean, it's one that I think a lot about. You know, it's really important for me that my kid be really allowed to explore her imagination and kind of be a kid for as long as she wants to, you know, that there's not, I mean, I think what happens in education a lot in this country is that, you know, kids are not very old when they are forced to sit in at those desks all day and do this kind of busy work. And it a lot of times the work is not in sync with the development. So you have kids, you know, like you can teach a kid to read. I've been reading up recently on the sort of developmental, I don't know, like basically how you teach a kid to read and when you teach a kid to read. And it turns out that, you know, kids can learn to read without really fully understanding what it is that they're doing. Like, you can teach a kid to read at a young age, at four, let's say, but it'll mostly be memorization and guessing.
Right.
It won't truly be reading for comprehension.
Right.
And I think that's a good example of what the educational system often does is, you know, there's kind of a lockstep rigidity to it. So it's like at five, you learn to read. You may or may not be developmentally ready to fully get everything you should out of learning to read, out of the reading you do. But if you're in a conventional school, you're going to learn it at that time. And, you know, my impulse is to, you know, is to kind of like, focus less on that kind of structured learning and more on imagination and play and letting a kid progress at her own pace and get to these things when she gets to them, you know?
Organically, sort of. Mm.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I think it is sort of a factory system. You know, at the same time, I think, you know, I went to public schools and I'm glad that I did, and it's important to me to invest in that system. You know, I think a lot of us...
Did you go to college, Adam?
Yeah, I went to college. I even went to graduate school.
Where'd you go?
I went to Columbia University and also did a master's in fiction writing there.
Wow. And what's what are you working on now? I'm sorry, I interrupted your keep going.
I'm working on a bunch of things, man. At this point, I'm always kind of juggling a bunch of projects as a novelist, as a screenwriter. You know, Rage Is Back came out a year ago. I published another novel since called The Dead Run, which is a thriller. Rage Is Back was my fourth novel. So, I mean, I've been at this a while. I just adapted a children's book called The Pushcart War, which is one of my favorites for the screen, for Park Pictures. I have a young adult series that I'm co-writing with Alan Zweibel, who is a comedy legend. He was one of the original Saturday Night Live writers.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly. I was like, I know that name.
Yeah, Alan's great, man. He and I met at a book festival about a year ago and hit it off, decided we wanted to work together, and started working on this book, which is basically about a kid who starts exchanging letters through time with Benjamin Franklin.
Wow.
And then ends up traveling back to 1776 and fucking up the Declaration of Independence, and there's all wacky stuff. The book is called Benjamin Franklin, Huge Pain in My Ass.
That's funny. That's funny.
Yeah, it's been really fun to write. I'm basically writing the kids' parts, and Alan is writing Franklin's parts, because Alan is approximately Ben Franklin's age, whereas I am basically a 13-year-old, you know, in terms of my sophistication.
Well, yeah, thank God.
And since you're basically a 13-year-old, doesn't that mean that you could totally start reading comic books right now?
No, not at 37.
Oh,
but
he's basically 13.
We had Dan O'Brien on, who wrote a book that's about to hit shelves called Badass Presidents.
Fighting Presidents. How to Fight Presidents.
Fight Presidents. And it was basically about who would win in a fight among all the presidents in a UFC kind of, you know, in a brawl. I mean, who do you got?
What does he say ultimately? Who's
well,
the
he's got yeah. he's got Teddy Roosevelt. Because okay, Teddy Roosevelt, he boxed and, you know, all that. But
hard to imagine anybody knocking Taft down, though, because that dude weighed like 400 pounds.
he was a big dude. Well, I got Gerald Ford only because he was so big. And you always laugh at that.
Brian,
he was so big and he played.
Choice.
And he was drafted by the Bears as a middle linebacker. That's an NFL athlete. That's a whole different game.
Yeah, except for the fact that it's the effect of history, Brian. It's the effect of history. You know, Teddy Roosevelt was an amazing hipster. Like
he
ironically took on the role of a badass. Andrew Jackson was a badass.
Yeah, he was a killer of men.
Yeah, he was a killer. Yeah, yeah. He was committed genocide.
What do you think, Adam?
Lyndon Johnson was a big guy, too.
By the way, that's a good call.
That's an excellent choice.
That's a good call. He had a piece on him, too, from what I understand.
Yeah.
It was like 6'5", Texan. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, now they'll fight. They'll fight at the drop of a hat. You're right. That's a good call. Now Lyndon Johnson is right up there he's in my top three.
We can both agree that Lyndon Johnson is an excellent choice, but that doesn't suggest that Gerald Ford is okay.
Gerald Ford is a big, strong kid.
I did not realize that Ford was a recruited football player.
No, and he was a big man. I'm going to get his stats right now. He was 6'4". So.
But I think that's the other thing. So much of what you have to factor into is psychology. And Lyndon Johnson is pretty insane.
Yeah, no, that guy, from everything I've read, was a beast. I mean, he's that old school, you know, hand-wringing, you know, knife-turning, guy who could work the Senate and make anything happen kind of thing.
Yeah, and by the way, Gerald Ford was only 6 feet. I'm sorry, I'm just looking that up. So he's not as big as I thought he was. All right.
And Andrew Jackson.
And don't
forget
Abe Lincoln. Abe Lincoln was 6'4", and apparently very strong. So.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I guess you have to factor in like training take. I mean, are we talking, where does this match take place in the present? Like, does Lincoln get trained using modern techniques and equipment?
That's a good question, man. You gotta ask that question.
Have you watched Rocky IV? Modern techniques and equipment don't matter. Like, no matter how space age the Soviets are, it doesn't matter.
If you got
a grit and you got a log, that's all you need, a log in the woods.
I mean, I guess I'm thinking more like, you know, like, is somebody going to come along and be like, stop smoking cigarettes and eating nothing but mutton, you know, like.
No mutton and no cigarettes. Yeah, there are a lot of factors to take into account.
That is true. You take away Andrew Jackson's mutton, what's he going to do?
They were definitely hardcore people, man. Adam, we're looking forward to the next thing you come out with, man.
Thank you.
You know.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I'm so glad that I found your work now, because, I mean, obviously we found it through Go the Fuck to Sleep, but I mean, you do have such a distinctive voice, and you really have clearly thought out the world of The Rage Is Back, and I'm sure it's true for all the other novels too.
Thank you. Yeah, I had a lot of fun with Rage Is Back, and you know, the beauty of being a novelist is that you get to create a different world each time out. So that's you know, that's part of the fun.
Are you always nervous that you're not going to be able to do it again?
I mean, there's always some kind of anxiety associated with any book at any stage of the process. I mean, whatever I'm doing, I'm always wishing I was doing something else. Like when I'm writing a first draft, I'm like, man, I can't wait to like get to the end of this and start revising. That's when the book's really going to take shape. And when I'm revising, I'm always like, man, I can't wait for that open vista, that blank page again. That's really where the creativity happens. So, you know, it's a process. And then these days, a writer is also expected to pound the pavement and get out there and, you know, promote the book and talk up the book and do events. And, you know, luckily for me, that's a lot of fun. But, I mean, a lot of writers dread it. And you know, like, you know, I have a lot of friends who say the only thing worse than publishing is not publishing, because that running that gauntlet of publicity and anxiety around the being out in the world is like horrifying.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, it's embarrassing and doing all. What is your I like to ask this to people, you know, especially someone like yourself. What makes you angry about the world, and what would you do to change it?
Oh, God.
If I made you the emperor.
The world is such a horrifying place right now. I mean, I think about this all the time as a parent, you know, like. By the time my daughter is my age, like, is she going to spend most of her time, you know, hoping to get enough clean water to, like, live another day, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Is the ocean going to be a toxic wasteland?
I worry about those big things, too. I'll find myself sitting there worrying about drought. And it's like, there's nothing I can do about it, you know, but I just, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're at a very scary moment in terms of environmental stuff. Now, of course, I think the environmental movement is a very young one and has made some incredible strides, but it's hard not to be really terrified about sort of the world that, you know, that we'll hand over. And I think about the education stuff that we were talking about too. Those things are really scary to me. You know, I'm a political junkie. I am a close observer of national politics, and I try to be one of local politics, and you know, increasingly I'm doing some work around that. Like, after Go the Fuck to Sleep came out, we did a video that Sam Jackson starred in called Wake the Fuck Up, which was an Obama ad. And, you know, it's frightening to me to think that Obama is probably the most progressive president we can hope to elect. And to see how stymied he's been in so many ways is deeply depressing. My partner, my girlfriend, is Swedish. So there's always the specter of moving to Sweden, where none of this shit happens out there.
Well, they probably have their own problems for sure, but yeah.
They do, actually, you know.
The other thing that doesn't happen in Sweden is sunshine. So, you know, there's
It's actually beautiful in the summer, though. Stockholm.
Yeah,
the summer is great, man. I've spent a couple winters there, and it's nothing nice. And I don't want to do it.
Yeah. Come down.
I wrote a lot of Rages back there, and it was great because I would, in Sweden, the great thing is that I could work in cafes without being distracted. You get that nice like buzz of activity, but I don't understand anything that's being said. So I'm not getting distracted.
Yeah, know? That's a good point, man. That's a good point. Well, listen, man, we appreciate you joining the podcast, man. It's great to have somebody as colorful as yourself and somebody who thinks deeply about things and also is as funny as you are. So thanks for the book, and thanks, and keep doing what you're doing, man.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
And if you're out in LA, let us know, man.
Absolutely.
Let us know, all right? We'll bring you into the studio, or you just come out to a show or something.
Cool.
All right, man. Adam Monsbach, ladies and gentlemen, Go the Fuck to Sleep. And Rage is Back. Pick it up. Listen to it. Read it. Fill your mind. This has been Brian Callen, Hunter Motz, and Adam Monsbach. Later.
Bye-bye.
All right.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.